Welcome to the Breezy Breakfast Observance of International Women's Day. Our theme this year is Women Helping Women. In the 1920s, the Women's Labor League emerges in Canada to defend female workers, calling for equal pay, maternity leave, birth control, and minimum wage laws. Nellie McClung, Emily Murphy, Henrietta Edwards, Louise McKinney, and Irene Parlby were known as the Alberta Five, later the Famous Five. Because of their tireless efforts, in 1929, Canadian women were declared to be persons under the law. In 1952, married women could continue to work in the federal public services. In 1970, women's shelters are formed. In 1981, the Postal Workers Union, CUPW, won the right to maternity leave. In 1983, it became a criminal offense for a man to rape his wife. In 2016, Manitoba passes legislation to give victims of domestic violence paid and unpaid leave. We've come a long way in the past 100 years. How are we doing now? And what are the issues that need to be addressed? Our guests share their perspectives. Janice Folk Dawson is the former vice president of the Ontario Federation of Labour and was president of QP Local 1334 at the University of Guelph for many years. Janice is also the NDP candidate in the 2025 federal election for Guelph. Sly Castaldi is the executive director of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. Sly has been tireless in her work on behalf of women escaping domestic violence and abuse. Over to our moderators, Tanya and Phil.
Good morning on this sunny Thursday, March the 7th, 2024. March has come in like a lamb, but I'd be lying when I say that it might go out like a slightly larger lamb. Tomorrow is International Women's Day, so today we're talking about women helping women. In Indigenous societies, women were held in high esteem as caretakers for children, elders, the land, and the water. Daily activities included everything from working in the fields and gathering, trading, or preparing food, to taking care of the younger generations by teaching them how to preserve natural resources. Women cared for the sick using their medicinal knowledge. And when communities made decisions, women's voices were respected. They were trusted as cultural and spiritual leaders. I'm not saying that Indigenous women lived in a utopia. I am saying that we would do well to remember the traditional respect given to Indigenous women. Today, we're talking about women in labor and women in crisis. And now I'll hand it over to you, Phil.
Thank you very much, Tanya. I want to thank everybody for attending. I'd also like to thank Rise and Shine for making us welcome. Thanks to our Diner Divas, the Diner Divas taking over from Bev, to whom we wish a speedy recovery. I have it on good source that Bev is now at home. She's walking with a cane, and we truly appreciate any updates always. But again, thank you to Ashley. Somehow you miraculously keep our coffee and our teacups full. As we come to the anniversary of our 8th year community conversations at Breezy Breakfast, remind us all that we are here to engage in thoughtful dialogue about issues that affect our neighborhoods, our community, the city, the province, our nation, and which might also touch on challenges faced throughout the globe. I want to thank Tanya for somewhat of a feminine acknowledgement, and now I wish to do the territorial acknowledgement. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us towards reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. Welcome to Breezy Breakfast Observance of International Women's Day. Clara Zetkin, Rosa Luxemburg, the Pankhursts, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Doe, and for Canadians, most importantly, the Famous Five, Emily Murphy, Henrietta Richards, Nellie McClung, Louise McKinney, and Irene Parlby. Where would all of us be without them? I get goosebumps when I walk past the bronze installment on Parliament Hill that pays tribute to the women who dared claim that they were persons. Since then, women and their male allies standing together have worked for equal pay for equal value, maternity leave, birth control and reproductive choice, and I differentiate safe therapeutic abortions and much, much more. Our lives have been enlightened by this activism that has become to most of us so normal. And yet, our struggle continues. I would like to welcome our guests. Joining us at Rise and Shine is Janice Folk-Dawson, Special Assistant to QP Ontario and former Vice President of the Ontario Federation of Labour. I would be remiss if I did not point out that Janice is also NDP candidate for the 2025 federal election in Guelph. Sly Castaldi is no stranger to anyone who's been working within the community. She is Executive Director of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. She has been a tireless worker on behalf of women escaping domestic violence and abuse. Clearly, this is a labor of love and compassion and so sorely needed. Despite the gains women have made, we must still ensure that gender-based violence is treated seriously and victim-supported rather than victimized a second time. So welcome to Breezy Breakfast. I want to acknowledge that I am a male, and for me, I am learning. I'm sure it's no surprise to anybody from my voice that I'm a male. I honor my female and my non-binary teachers, treating all as equals, not just worthy of respect, but actually entitled to it as anybody else might be. I'm here to listen, to pose questions, and to be corrected when necessary. But the first question that I will ask you at some point is this. Why does feminism matter, and why is feminism an empowering F word? I think so many times this gets lost. But Janice, I'll turn it over to you for your remarks, first of all. Welcome.
Thank you, Phil. It's wonderful to be here today. So as Phil said, my name is Janice Folk-Dawson. My pronouns are she and her. I'm a settler who resides on Upper Canada Treaty Number 3 territory. I am working on understanding that treaty and my obligations to the treaty. As a feminist and a trade unionist, I understand the importance of understanding and enacting a contract. I also recognize that we have obligations to demand that all levels of government enact all 94 calls to action from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. As we reflect on our individual responsibilities to those calls, we must remember that we have obligations. I'm an injured worker with a permanent disability. I know I'm a rare example of an injured worker who was returned to work after several surgeries and 18 months off work. And I'm very privileged to have succeeded in being elected to the Provincial House of Labor. I've been a unionized public sector worker for over 45 years. I have been a renter my entire life. I have never lived in a house that was owned by my family. I am grateful for the invitation this morning and to have the opportunity and reason to reflect on women helping women. I reflect from my labor working class perspective and want to comment on women's roles in influencing unions and the labor movement as a whole. I've identified my bias for you in my description of myself. In my lifetime, I recognize that incredible gains have been made. Both of my grandmothers immigrated to a country where they did not have the right to vote and were not considered persons. My mother, who was a Saskatchewan Bell operator, was not allowed to wear pants to work and had to quit when she married my father in 1947. When I got married in 1978, I had to pay to have my name changed, as I was not allowed to keep my maiden name or hyphenate it without paying a fee. We need to recognize that women led the 1917 strike. We need to recognize that women led the days of action in 1995. And most recently, women school board workers led the school board strike last fall. When you reflect on women's roles in influencing unions and the labor movement, we need to begin by understanding what jobs women are occupying and union density. Of all paid workers in Ontario, approximately 75% work in the private sector and 25% work in the public sector. Union density in Ontario is at 26.3%. That's the 2023 stat. That means that over 70% of workers in Ontario are not unionized. Most jobs in the public sector are unionized, and the workers are predominantly white and able-bodied. The majority of jobs in the private sector are not unionized, and high numbers of workers are Black, Indigenous, or racialized. Workers with disabilities are not visible in either the public or private sector. During the 1970s through to the 1990s, as more white women became union members, feminists became active and worked to push our union leadership that was male-dominated to take up issues such as employment equity, childcare, maternity leave, and sexual harassment. Gains were made at the bargaining table on many issues, and some of those changes made it into legislation, which meant that all women benefited, whether union or non-union. It should be noted that feminists were pushing for these issues to be priorities from women's committees positions, not from union leadership roles. We gathered at conferences and in caucuses to talk out strategies and to learn from each other what work could create change. Often, our issues were the first to fall off the bargaining table. The issue of reproductive rights and the right to my body, my choice, were fought by feminists in the street and legislative process with the support of unions, but reproductive rights were not taken up at many bargaining tables. Even today, we don't see many unions taking up the issue of coverage for fertility treatments or fertility drugs, yet most benefit plans will cover Viagra or other erectile dysfunctional drugs. Changes and gains have been made in many areas, but there are many failures also that we must recognize. Pay inequity exists inside our collective agreements. First, by allowing percentage wage increases, we gave up cost of living in most collective agreements years ago and moved to percentage wage increases. Yet the cost of living goes up the same for the lowest wage band as the highest wage band. In most collective agreements, the highest wage bands are male-dominated classifications such as trades, and the lower wage bands are female-dominated such as admin or care providers. There are collective agreements in female-dominated bargaining units that have a wage grid, meaning it sometimes takes years to get to job rate. Male-dominated bargaining units have two rates of pay, probation and job rate. If you have the qualifications to get the job, you have the right to the same pay and benefits as the worker doing the same work beside you from day one. Most PPEs, personal protective equipment, have been designed for men, such as harnesses, and employers are not upgrading or adjusting unless a union pushes for. Employers provide urination and defecation supplies, but not menstruation products. It's not even on the bargaining table. We have made some gains under childcare, but we need to acknowledge that it is not working for all women. Access to and affordability of childcare for night shift workers is not even a discussion we have in the feminist movement or in the childcare movement, and it is not on any bargaining table that I know of. We also need to acknowledge who's providing the childcare and cleaning our homes and what rate of pay we deem acceptable for that care work. And while those folks are taking care of our children at home, who is taking care of their children and cleaning their homes? Union leadership, both public sector and private sector, tends to be white, able-bodied males. Even teachers' unions' top officers were all male until approximately 6 years ago, even though their membership were mainly women. We finally have a Black woman, Karen Brown, as the president of ETFO, and a Black woman, Yolanda McLean, as the secretary treasurer of CUPE Ontario and president of CBTU, the Coalition of Black Trade Union Canada. The reason most public sector unions have equality representatives on their provincial and national executive is because of constitutional equity seats, not because equity representatives were elected to other positions on the executive. Family responsibility and work balance are not often prioritized in collective bargaining, and employers are not open to providing them, even though it is one of the working conditions that determines satisfaction, productivity, and retention of workers. If these are the struggles that unionized women workers experience, we can only speculate on how difficult being non-union worker women workers are. What can we do to create an environment that sees women working conditions improve, whether unionized or non-unionized? We need to begin that all workers, especially women, need to learn and understand the Occupational Health and Safety Act, that green book. Then, first, you need to work from the principle, what you permit, you promote. When you see an injustice, you take the action needed to change that, whether it be at the bargaining table, on the streets, or in the court. Second, you need to recognize your privilege, your class, your gender or binary experience, and your skin color. Third, recognize the growth of being called in. When your behavior is corrected, take it as an opportunity to unlearn colonial corporate behavior. The person calling you in believes you and others in the room will do better when you know better. And finally, I always work from the perspective that together we are the collective intelligence, and collectively we can create the change needed to improve working conditions. So that means that I believe we should all be working to improve access to a union, which is the form of collectives we have. And I believe as a woman workers, we have an obligation to engage in our workplace union or association and to be active in all three levels of government. It's feminists that will change the women's working conditions, women, men, and non-binary feminists. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Janice. I think you've provided us with a very clear perspective on why the workplace is still an important battleground for women in the fight for rights. Sly, it's been a while since you and I have talked. For many of you here, you would know Sly from her tireless activism on behalf of women who truly are in crisis. Sly, I'm going to pass it over to Tanya, but I hope at some point you'll make an announcement about the events that are going on tomorrow during the day and at night as well. I think that they are definitely worthwhile for people to attend. So, Tanya, if you would, please.
Sly, you are the executive director of Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis. I would like you to take the opportunity to let us know about the organization and how many women are served and anything that we as a community should know about Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis.
Thanks, Tanya. Thanks, Phil. And thanks, Janice. You laid the groundwork very nicely for our conversation. I think I'd like to take it to the theme about women helping women and what lots of people don't know about women in crisis is now. I think we're in our 47th year. We were founded in 1977. So, but in that theme of women helping women, there was a group of young women at the University of Guelph. There's an argument between whether it was five women or eight women. Can't really be 100% sure, but somewhere between five and eight women. We're getting concerned about sexual violence that was happening at the University of Guelph. And so in the 70s, where social change and activism was in your blood, basically, these young women decided to do something about it and wanted to provide support to women who were experiencing this at the university. So one of them was dating the president of the student union, and he gave them a room in the university center and a telephone, and they started a crisis line. So these women would start answering the crisis line for anyone who was looking for information around having experienced sexual assault. And they ran this line for like a year, and in that year, they were getting calls from women in the city who were experiencing domestic violence. And these women didn't know what to do because the women who were calling were desperate to get out, but there was nowhere to go. And so they regrouped. They do what activists did back in those days. They regrouped and decided to somebody, some kind gentleman in the community, gave them a basement apartment. And they started to hide women and kids in that basement apartment. And that became really the genesis of our organization. And from that basement apartment, they were able to get another bigger house and another house and another house and funding until the organization grew to what it is today. But that's how it started. Women helping women, and in this case, very young women at the university helping their peers. And so the foundation, the backbone, the spirit of this organization has always been women helping women, right? And unfortunately, the organization has always seen a need to keep growing. To the day that we are today, where the organization has always evolved and morphed into what women on the crisis line were asking for. So, for example, in the beginning, it was sexual violence and sheltering. That's what they needed most. Women needed a place to get away to be safe, right? And then they started getting calls from women in the county. So in rural, like in, you know, Wellington County is very, very large. And women were calling saying, there's nowhere for me to go. I can't get off my farm. There's, you know, neighbors don't hear you, all that kind of stuff. And so then the Rural Women's Shelter Program was created. And that, you know, and we have offices in four of our county communities, Erin, Mount Forest, Fergus, and Palmerston, all meeting the needs of rural women. So they provide services on domestic violence and sexual violence in those communities. And then women started calling because they needed support, but they didn't need to go into the shelter. So the transition program was created in the early 20s. Is that how you say 2000s? In the early 2000s. And that was created because women needed all the support to get away, to stay away, to think about getting away. But they didn't necessarily need to go into the shelter. So our transition and housing program was created. And then we started getting requests for women who weren't represented in family court or unrepresented, and the two-hour legal aid certificate wasn't providing enough support. So then we were able to get funding for the family court support program. And then finally we were able to get, and then human trafficking made its appearance. And we needed, and we were able to get funding for the human trafficking program. So the agency has been responding to needs ever since it was created. So we don't stay stagnant in, this is what we think gender-based violence looks like. This is what we think the support looked like. This is what we offer. We've been responding and nimble to the needs of women and kids in our community, since its inception. And so, and we continue to do that to this day. So basically that's where we are. And to Phil's question of why it's important, my agency is a representation of why feminism is still important today, because we have not ended gender-based violence. And I used to think when I first started this work 30 plus years ago, I won't get into the specifics, but I used to think that in my career, I was going to see an end to this, which sadly learned that I doubt it's going to happen in my lifetime. But we have not, sure, we've put a dent in it, but we have not ended gender-based violence. Women still don't have the same freedoms politically, socially, economically, that men have. And our bodies become a battleground for any political group that wants to score points, that wants to bring forward a more conservative outlook on or policies in our society. And you don't have to look very far than to our neighbors to the south to know that whenever they want to change the social structures, they attack women first. Our bodies become a battleground in area of conflict. That one of the ways to always destroy a country is to rape the women. So if you need, you don't need to look very far. If you look at politically what happens to female candidates when they run, Phil, you should know this more than anyone, of what they go through, and it doesn't become a very friendly place for women to put their hats in the ring. Economically, you know that as women age, they become more vulnerable by a long shot to men of living in poverty. So there's a whole host of reasons. We still don't make as much as our counterpart as men. There's a whole host of reasons why feminism is still important today, and I would argue sometimes even more important today because of the swing of the conservative religious agenda that is plaguing many countries in the world. So that's me. That's our agency. We service about, people need to understand, every year Guelph Wellington Women in Crisis services about over 1,000 women in Guelph and Wellington County. That is a lot of women we serve every year. Our crisis lines respond to over 3,000 calls a year. That is a lot of people who are in crisis, who need support in our community. And when I talk about these kind of statistics, people are often surprised or in disbelief. But that is the kind of violence that's happening, gender-based violence, that is happening in our community every day, just like communities across this country, right? We're no different. And so it's important to us, for us to understand that, you know, Women in Crisis stands as a beacon for women and kids who need support. But the numbers that we see every year are staggering. And the numbers of femicide, I also want to point out, in this province have been increasing every year. I tell the story that, you know, we buy these picture frames for December 6th. So we have a picture of every woman or a story about them or their names in these picture frames as part of our vigil. And we used to have 40 of them, and it used to be enough. In the past few years, we've had to go and purchase more of these things because the numbers are now up to 60 each year that are murdered, femicide, because of gender-based violence. That's a huge increase, right? And those numbers are not going down, right? So it's important that the community, our community, that Guelph and Wellington County rally behind making gender-based violence a priority and supporting women and kids in our community who need that kind of support.
I just wanted to seg into the fact that last November, Guelph declared intimate partner violence is an epidemic.
Yes,
and very soon, I believe that Wellington County will do the same.
We presented to them, it's under consideration.
So what I wanted to ask you is, how do you think that this will make a difference to women who are in crisis?
You know, it's a really good question, Tanya. But for me, the issue is, it was one of the recommendations that came from the Renfrew inquest. And as you know, the province has refused to declare it an epidemic. But communities are declaring it an epidemic. And part of our ask is for municipalities to put pressure on the provincial government to declare this an epidemic. And the numbers would certainly indicate that, yeah, we are in that category of this is a serious issue and it's impacting a lot of people. For me, the important thing around this was that it wasn't going to be an exercise that was largely performative. So it needs to have teeth. It needs to have actions behind it to make it something that is important. So lots of communities, I think there's over 100 now, but they're wanting to get it into their communities, the safety and well-being plans, which is a good start. But there also has to be support, financial support behind it. There has to be a priority. Like you guys all know, Guelph is in a major housing crisis, right? So declaring it an epidemic is important. But unless there's places for women and kids to go, my shelter is largely full most of the time. So where do women go? Where do women and kids go? If they can't get into the shelter because women can't leave the shelter because there's no affordable housing, then we have a bottleneck, right? So to me, yes, it's important to declare it an epidemic, but all like many communities are experiencing this housing crisis. So how do we do that so that there is support for women who want to leave, who to be able to get out, right? So we need housing. We need the basic income so that people aren't living in poverty like state because they're choosing their own lives, their and their kids to get out, but then they're trying to live on the amount from Ontario Works, right? You have no money and you have no place to go. How many women and kids do you think will leave? Right? So without a guaranteed basic income, without housing, without legal supports, without these kind of things, what do people think will happen? Right? So for me, declaring it is the first step. Then how do we work to really make this real? This is what I mean. Like, it's good to declare it. It's important. Let's, at least the municipalities have done it, whereas the provincial government won't touch it. The reason the provincial government won't touch it is because then they have to put resources towards it. And nobody wants to do that, right?
Absolutely. Thank you very much. You are listening to Breezy Breakfast. And I just want to go back to a couple of those points and hear from both of you. An interesting issue that is part of Women Helping Women is the question of a living wage. Is the living wage an issue that should be embraced as an issue of women seeking equity in the workplace and at home? And Janice, I think I'll start with you.
I think that it is the basic first step is that a living wage, and we need to get rid of to convince people that the percentage wage increases that our employers are giving, giving to the bargaining units directly affect women. Percentage wage increases not only mean that we're making less money while we're on the job, it means that our pension benefits are going to be less because we're not keeping up with the cost of living. So actually, by doing percentage wage increases instead of across the board, where everyone in that bargaining unit is making the same across the board wage increase, is really discriminatory towards women. I like the idea of a living wage, but we need to talk about the difference between a living wage and the percentage wage increases, because if we still do it in percentage wage increases instead of doing across the board, that's the only way we're going to raise women's wages. If we continue to do it on percentages, we continue to discriminate against women in the workplace.
Thank you. Sly, what about yourself?
Yeah, I think living wage is incredibly important for women who are able to work. There's a lot of women who are on disability, so that's not going to resolve everything, Phil. I think a living wage with also the guaranteed annual income would help to sort of do those kind of things. But also, I think you have to deal with the inequity in wages between men and women. So there's a whole bunch of things that are in that. That's not just about a living wage, because I can't even remember now what the living wage for Guelph is, but housing is unaffordable in this community.
And that was the question I was going to segue into. Housing and homelessness are clearly important current issues in Guelph. And I was wondering if I could both of you to comment on that from the perspective of women and Indigenous women and women in color, as well as refugees. Does this take on a different scope when we put gender and race to it, or is it the same for everyone?
No, of course, the impacts are different for different communities, because some communities are more marginalized than others, for sure. So I think that for what we see, Phil, first of all, even if our experiences have been, even if women can find a place to live, which is a big if, but even if they go meet landlords, if they're a person of color, if they're differently able, if they're marginalized, landlords can be pretty and just find a whole host of ways of discriminating and not giving them those places. So there's a lot of factors that play into a whole bunch of things. And for me, housing should be a human right. In a country as rich as ours, housing should be a human right.
Hey, thanks. So let's go to Janice on that one. And Janice, you've had experience working with migrant workers and so on. I wonder if maybe you could even bring that piece in.
Well, and we do need to look at the housing conditions of, as you say, migrant workers and of refugees. I mean, I wonder how many people in Guelph even recognize the 35 refugees that we had that were being housed at the Holiday Inn. And that, you know, we're kept on the outskirts of town and having to try to access any of the services that would be in town. We don't think of, you know, I'm thinking, I know everybody's talking about the housing issue, and we're all moving forward to thinking of, you know, this housing that's being built in places where the housing is not perhaps really needed. But we're not talking about what's happening tonight. For women who have, you know, to find some shelter for their children and for that can't make it into any of the shelters that we have. And we have encampments in this city, and those encampments are not safe. And so what we say to people, to women and to children, is that there's housing coming, and we're not talking about actually how could we make those encampments safe so that there would be a place for women and children to go. And there is a possibility of being able to do that. We did it during, you know, we were able to make encampments safe during the Occupy movement when we made safe kitchens and we had workers on site. None of that conversation is happening right now in our community or in communities across the province. So for women on tonight, there is no safe housing available to them. And politicians and community activists, we keep looking farther into the future instead of within the next couple of hours what we can give to someone. And the women are really suffering because of that.
And clearly the applause suggests that people can identify with that. I want to carry on with that a little bit, because you had mentioned housing for women. And when you said tonight, I know that you mean every night of the year.
Absolutely.
And that's important. But the other point that I'd love to hear from both you and Sly, and maybe Sly has a bit of expertise on this, is the issue of shelters and emergency housing or an emergency bed for people. It is my understanding that women are particularly uncomfortable going into shelters, and that one of the reasons is that there is always the threat of violence and or sexual violence. Jan, I think I'll let you go first, and then Sly, if you could follow up, that'd be great.
I think that is indeed true. It is, you know, we need to recognize that the experience of women that are looking for housing and their experience of what means a safe environment for them. And so a lot of times it is the fear of encounters that they're going to have, but it is also the whole relationship and the power struggle that is inside of that shelter system, right? Of women not knowing what their rights are, not knowing what they're able to actually, other assistance that they're able to have. So I look at, you know, I've been told that folks have to be careful, have to be clear on what it is that they want to take in with them. The shelter system needs to be able to provide a safe space. Part of being a safe space is knowing that physically you're safe in there, but also that materially the only things that you have are able to come into the shelter with you, and you're able to take care of what your world is. And if you can't do that, that's a form of violence also against women, right? Not being able to have the only things that they want with them. So I think that a lot of the fears of women going into shelters are something that we need to be able to unpack of how we could change those barriers. But I think that there's definitely a big concern. I know that there's even a big concern when people are accessing the bench. And other, right? Women are very fearful in what the relationship that's going to develop from that.
Thank you. And Sly, just before you get going, I just want to be very clear. I am not talking about the shelter afforded by women in crisis and sexual assault centers. This is substantially different.
Yeah, I'm talking about
shelters for those who are, quote, living rough. But Sly, is this an issue for women?
I think the interesting thing from my perspective is that shelters were never made to be a part of a permanent solution on housing. They're supposed to be an emergency stopgap around something where somebody has run into some pretty bad, unfortunate circumstances and needs a little something to get back on their feet. Our shelter systems now are becoming a form of housing. And because the way shelters were built, they weren't built with safety features in mind, I don't think. Perhaps they were built to house a whole bunch of people as easily as possible. If shelters were really made with some sort of safety features, it would be nice if everybody had their own room where, you know, you could shut a door, lock a door, or whatever, feel a little safer. That's not the way they are. That kind of sheltering is too expensive. So we warehouse them in big, big places. And we also warehouse people who may be experiencing significant mental health, significant addictions, and we expect for it to all go okay. Right? It's not a model in this day and age that can sustain itself the way it's presently set up. It's just not able to keep going like this. And we hear that. We hear that from trans folks who, you know, are afraid to go into any of the shelters because they would feel victimized pretty quickly. We hear it from women have a particularly difficult time in some shelters. And so then what happens is, I'll just be honest with you guys, then sometimes people want to come into our shelter, and our shelter specifically for abused women and kids who are leaving abusive, violent relationships, homes that need to, it's a specific kind of support. And so, but if your options are very limited and it's either going into this kind of scary environment or trying to get into WIC, they would rather try to get into WIC, but it's not an appropriate place because we also have kids who are traumatized from being in violent and abusive homes. And so that can become really, really challenging for a communal living house. Ours is a house. It's built on the model of, again, women helping women being supportive to each other, going through similar experiences to let them know you're not alone. I went through it too. You know, it's going to be okay. No judgment, those kind of things, which is very different than a homeless shelter, right? And so these are really, really, they're complicated issues, right? So, but I think that the way the current shelter system is set up is not very, it doesn't make it any safer for women. The other thing I'll throw into the mix just for fun is because oftentimes too, shelters where you might get homeless youth accessing it, they're also vulnerable to human trafficking because there's nobody keeping an eye on them. There's no family to sort of check in with them and stuff. So they become vulnerable to other things. It's all very, very complicated. What goes on in the shelters, the vulnerabilities, the victimization, it's not a simple solution. Shelters were never meant to be a solution. That's the issue.
And thank you very much. Tanya has asked me, and I was thinking the same thing, but she'd had an earlier question. Can we pick up on traffic? And I want to do that, Sly. I'll start with Sly and then Janice, I'll go to you. But the issue of human trafficking is one that I deal with from the perspective of Guelph Police Services. But it is something that I think is more immediate, perhaps, to both of you. I'm sure that it has an impact on issues associated with the workplace, with migrant workers, just with people trying to escape family violence or violence from friends. Sly, can you give us a lowdown on human trafficking in this area and across Canada?
First of all, what I want to say is whatever you've seen on TV is not what human trafficking looks like. So start right there. It's not like the movie Taken or any of that kind of stuff. So, you know, I think you have to work really hard to rid your mind of those myths. Secondly, I would encourage people to go to the Aurora site. We have it up. We post a lot of their stuff because it's really, 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 really good. So. And I want to say, ooh, Guelph is not the hub for like whatever human trafficking. Any community on the 401 corridor has human trafficking because it's how you transport the young women or the folks for trafficking. So we're no different than any other community on that 401 corridor. So that's really important. But also it's not a Liam Neeson movie. So it might look like all of a sudden somebody who might be more isolated or might not have a lot of friends or might not have a lot of attention from boys all of a sudden has somebody who's taken some interest in them and the grooming process begins. So it doesn't always start from this kind of violent, scary thing. Sometimes it starts as a relationship. And the closer that they get, then the more they push the boundaries on things that they want them to do. Or a friend starts, makes a friend and says, hey, I know how to get an iPhone, or hey, I know how to do this, and gets them into that particular world. It doesn't always start off with this scary kind of stuff. And that's why it looks weird and it's hard for people to even identify themselves that they're actually victims of human trafficking, right? And oftentimes drugs does become a part of that process. And then once you get someone hooked on drugs, you lose them to that world, right? And that's why group homes are particularly vulnerable to young women being recruited from them, because nobody's keeping them out and stuff. And the more vulnerable you are, the easier it is for the traffickers to actually get their hooks on you. But what I want to say is it doesn't look always like that violence. Sometimes it is, but rarely. What we see are women who get groomed into it through the traffickers and friends.
And Janice, one thing that's always bothered me is the number of those who have been human trafficked who are actually working in factories or industrial settings. I'm sure that you at both the Ontario Federation of Labour and at CUPE have some knowledge of this and regrettably, perhaps even some experience having dealt with this. Give us a lowdown on the workplace and human trafficking.
Well, and I think it is sort of the dirty secret of the workforce. And I think we need to think about it happening in three places. We know that it's happening with migrant workers, and what's happening is people are recognizing that some migrant workers are struggling with the system and that they're offering them another way out of, you know, and they're making it sound really rosy, that, you know, how bad it is with their migrant. There's another road that they can take, and that is over. They're not recognizing that they're being like slid over into the human trafficking narrative, and that's the type of work that they're going to take on. The other place that we see that it is actually happening is with refugees. And refugees in our community and many communities house refugees in hotels or churches in some cases. But there's obviously there's a gathering place, and these predators know where those gathering places are, know that refugees are very vulnerable, not really understanding what they're actually getting into or what they're actually being told. And so we see another stream of refugees going into human trafficking. And then there are folks that have come to our country looking for work, don't have the papers that they need to have. So they're targeted also in our workplaces by other co-workers that channel them into human trafficking. So we're seeing entry through the workforce in three places: through migrant workers, through refugees, and through folks who are working but don't have papers, and so are very vulnerable to somebody leading them down another path.
I would also add domestic workers, where we've seen a lot of stuff that they get tricked into coming over as domestic workers. I just, if I have a second, I want to tell you guys a feel good story. But we had we got a call from the hospital. This was about maybe more than 5 years ago. So I feel okay about telling you the story. But there was a woman, a South Asian woman, elderly woman at the hospital, and the social worker thought that there was something weird because she didn't have her passport, didn't have anything, was just dropped off. And she was really quite sick. She was in her mid-70s. And they called us, and we were able to get a translator. And what we figured out is that she was being trafficked, labor trafficked. Somebody brought her in and was making her work like literally all night in their business and all day with the family, and she was getting sick. And so the hospital told the person that they needed to keep her overnight for observations. We went to the hospital, picked her up, brought her to the shelter, and we kept her for like 6 months because she'd never been outside, because she was never allowed to go outside. So we were afraid that if she did go outside, she'd get lost. She didn't speak any English. She didn't have anything. But during those 6 months, we were able to get her hooked up with ESL classes through the senior support center. We were able to get her a place to live. And it turned into a feel-good story, all because the social worker clued in that something wasn't right. And between the hospital and us, we were able to actually get this woman out of trafficking. So it's one of the feel-good stories. I thought we should end on a positive note.
Much of what we're talking about is pretty heavy stuff. And I think we need all the positives we can. And I think it plays perfectly into the theme of women helping women. And with that, there are actually three female politicians with us today: Sly Castaldi, Aaron Caton, and Janice Folk Dawson. And all of them have had experiences at the ballot box, some positive, some negative. And I'm going to start with Aaron. Aaron, I worked with you quite a bit during the election, and proud to work with you after the election. You've shared with me many of the challenges that you have faced that are not the same as those which I face. I was wondering if you could just briefly give us an idea of what you, as somebody who identifies as both she and they, experienced and continue to experience. And Sly and Janice, I would love to hear your perspectives on feminist politics in an aquarium that is generally dominated by men. Aaron.
So I'm non-binary, so I kind of call International Women's Day International Misgendering Day for me, because I get a lot of Happy Women's Day. I'm like, I'm woman adjacent. So I'm like, I definitely perceived as woman. I have a lot of the same issues that women go through. But I've noticed, as for myself in politics, that a lot of the issues that I run into are specifically from folks who are gender critical, is what we are calling that group right now. And I've had to go to the police multiple times in my first year and a half of being a counselor. And I heard that that's not normal. Like, most people don't have to go through that. So that's something that I think that people aren't really aware of, just the level of harassment that you get when you are not a man. And I was warned to, like, bring somebody with me to the doors when canvassing and never be alone. And that's something that you don't necessarily have to experience otherwise. So there's a lot that kind of goes on there that you have to be more aware of your surroundings and try extra hard to get the same results. And a lot of the time when we're talking about equity, that's what we're discussing, is trying to make it so that people who are not in the easiest gender position in life don't have to work three times as hard to get to the same area. I wanted to thank Sly and Janice for all their work, because Janice really, really helped a lot with the transgender protests, counter protests that we were working with. And Sly, your group gets, I don't know if you're in the Guelph Mom group, but the Guelph Mom group on Facebook, you get referred to all the time because of sad situations that women are in relationships. So I really appreciate the work that both of you do.
Sly, because the theme is women helping women, Janice is going to be on the hustings soon. Your experiences also might be of value to Janice as she takes on the challenge.
Mm-hmm. I think that, first of all, anyone who puts their hat in the ring always deserves huge respect, especially if you are a woman or non-binary or trans. Because I think it's an experience like no other. But I think that the sexism, homophobia, transphobia, all of it play a whole bunch of different levels that's always reserved for candidates who are not male, cisgendered male. And you can be like almost perfect in any category, and it's still not good enough. You can be breathing as a man and still win. No offense, but the bar for men in politics is so low, and the bar for anyone else is incredibly high. It's been my experience. It's not about character. It's not about qualifications. It's not about anything other than, you know, that there are people who still believe that men should rule the world. Patriarchy still has its foothold on everything, and it's destroying our world. No offense, people, but I've had it with the sexism. I've had it with the homophobia. I've had it with all of it, because, you know, one of the things that I always believe is that if we work together, regardless of your political stripes, we work together to resolve some major issues, we have a way forward of being able to save this planet and our people. But when we continue to stay in that power structure, it's destroying everything. And like, take a look at what's happening to the South. And if you don't think that that could happen here, you're sadly mistaken. You have a man who's up on multiple charges, who's crazy, and still is in the lead to become the president of one of the most powerful countries in the world. That tells you that there is something fundamentally wrong. right? And even in our own country, you look at, you know, if you look at what Pierre Poilievre puts forward, nothing other than criticism of Trudeau, and he is going to unfortunately be the next prime minister, right? If you don't think that that's frightening, give your head a shake. Start demanding more. Start demanding more from our politicians, regardless of their stripes or gender or whatever, right? I honest to God, Phil, that was one of the, like, it was one of the hardest experiences I've ever went. But because I look like who I look like and nothing more, people would come to me, to my office, and say, you are the most qualified candidate in terms of your resume, experience, all this kind of stuff. But they hated Wynne. They hated her. And when I would ask people, why do you hate her? Nobody would be honest. Nobody would be honest. Nobody would say it because she was a woman. Nobody would say it because she was a lesbian. They would find some random things to try and pinpoint. But Doug Ford can do all sorts of crazy stuff, and he gets all sorts of accolades. He gets forgiveness. He gets breathing room. He gets all sorts of things because he's a man. Right? Sorry. I mean, it's a trigger for me. That experience is a trigger for me.
Well, I'm glad that we could offer this opportunity for catharsis and therapy. I totally appreciate what you're saying. I was there. I witnessed some of what you experienced, but certainly I could not personalize it. And I think it's important for people to hear from you the challenges both today and the challenges for women and those of undefined gender experiencing politics. Janice.
So, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Sly for sharing that with us. And I witnessed some of it too, Sly, that you went through. But I've also been witnessing across the province right now, women in Cornwall have resigned their seats on municipal because of the attacks that is happening on them. I noticed that, you know, it's been referenced that I am a woman, but it's also been referenced that I'm a disabled woman. And so what am I doing there? And I've been challenged, on that issue, but I want to pick up on something that Sly said that, I am very frightened at the time that we are in right now. And I think that we have two responsibilities. And one of them is to make sure that we're raising our children to be feminists, and we're convincing our partners and our family members to become feminists, and to really understand what that means and the obligations, what that means. And when Sly started to talk about Pierre Poilievre, I am very frightened. My entry into feminism was on the issue of abortion, fighting for abortion rights. And if folks just notice, the last abortion clinic in PEI just closed. New Brunswick has no access to it. And we're about to put into power a conservative government at a federal level that would mean that they have enough conservative power to be able to change the constitution in this country, which will fundamentally destroy any of the women's rights that we have been able to attain. And so part of the reason why I've stepped up to this plate is because I am determined that I will not have to go back to the fights that we had to do in the 60s and 70s for women's rights. And the only way that we can do that is actually to put women and non-binary folks in power to make sure that that constitution does not get destroyed and that we continue to hold our rights.
And thank you to all three of you for expressing your very heartfelt concerns. I do know that I've talked to Erin, and I know that she won't mind quite frequently about some of what is happening. And I've been very clear, when this stuff happens, you go to the police, full stop. There's no place for hate. And it brings us back to our themes, women helping women. And as I'm closing off, there is one last question for me. Now, it was said that feminism is perhaps even more important today. But the challenge for me, and just for my guests, I'll start with Janice and then go to Sly. What about male allies? And what about males who claim to be feminists. Is that really a thing? Janice?
I definitely think that we need to have male allies. Most certainly, if those allies are not at the bargaining tables for us, are not in the legislature for us, we are fighting a fight that we can't win without their support. I do believe that there are men. I certainly know men who I believe are feminists. There are a lot of men who like to use the term feminist, but are not. But there are a lot of women who will use the term feminist. And I want to add one other point, too, is we need to think about that there is distinctively working class feminism and there is white feminism. And we need to be able to identify what it is in each of those and to be able to claim the feminism that works for us.
And that sounds like a whole other show as well. But Sly, from your point of view, I will have one more question because I'm not ending this off with a question about males. There's one more after this. But Sly, what about male allies and male feminists?
I believe wholeheartedly in male allies, and I believe that men can be feminists. It would be really, really nice if men weren't getting so much currency for having the label of ally or male feminist, as opposed to, you know, like when shit happens to a female politician, if it's the men who are leading the charge, not having to let the person impacted the most always have to be the complaining. When I start to see the shift, I'll have more belief in it. Of course, I want to believe it with all my heart. We need to fight these fights together. We need to change the world together. But I think the problem is that there is still so much, men benefit so much still from patriarchy that it's hard to let it go. So until I start seeing more of that evidence, of course, I want to embrace it. I want to embrace it. But, you know, patriarchy is still really, 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 it's hard fighting it.
Thank you. And I'm just going to make the comment that the statement was made that our bodies are a battleground. And I think that sometimes we lose sight of what that means. Sly, give me the Reader's Digest version of what that means.
If women don't have control over their own bodies, then we've got nothing. Right? We went through a pandemic here. And this is the part that made me kind of like, oh, like it just became so obvious. We went through a pandemic and there was a whole movement started because people didn't even want to wear a mask because they didn't want to have a vaccine. It's my body, it's my right. But somehow that is never afforded to women, that they, what they can do with their own bodies, what the rights they have over their own bodies. And to me, it's like our bodies always become up for negotiations, depending on the political climate environment, depending on communities, depending on war, depending on if you're a woman and there is someone who wants to do, like I always used to do this when I would train people, is that women can be safe as long as there's not a perpetrator around. But if someone wants to do you harm, they can, just because of the nature of being a woman. Do you understand? Our bodies are always a battleground. And that does not happen to men.
I've learned a ton today. And I want to appreciate both of you for having been here. And I'm sure that people that are in the restaurant and online appreciate everything that they've learned today. I wish you the best as we observe International Women's Day year round. I would encourage people to please remember every December, the Montreal Massacre. And remember every gender-based atrocity that occurs throughout the year, because they're not going away very quickly. And like Sly, I wish that you no longer had to do your job. I'd love to put you out of business, but the reality is that there are still struggles that with which we must continue. So Sly Castaldi, thank you very much for your continued efforts to support women in the community who are suffering physical, emotional and financial violence. And to Janice, thank you very much for working to improve the the lot of women through collective bargaining, through union work, and through making certain that everyone enjoys a safe, secure workplace and a decent wage. Thank you, both of you, and thank Aaron as well for your experiences on council. Tanya.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go on to the announcements. Have your say. The Drew Park revitalization is happening. There's a survey and it's open until March 31st. Also open until March 31st is the Downtown Heritage Conservation District. You can send in your comments and take a survey. The York Road reconstruction is happening. There is an open house on Tuesday, March the 19th from 6 to 8 p.m. happening at Guelph City Hall. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we are going to have an update on the Downtown Renewal Project. Reg Rustworm and Andrew Miller and another member of staff will be there in person. And coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be talking about Guelph climate and environmental activism and tiny homes. So thank you all for being here today. Thank you to Janice and to Sly. And I believe that's a wrap.
That's all for today. Thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to our guests, Janice and Sly. Music provided by Jules Germ, and the podcast was produced by the CFRU Media Center. See you next week.